Recovery Radio, KMP3, Thousand Oaks.
Yes. Are listening to Recovery Radio, KMP3. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will be your host. So happy you tuned in today to this second episode of Recovery Radio on KMP3. Going to continue talking about early recovery. I myself am gratefully happy, joyous, and free. I have been sober since 1989. And I always have to start by telling you, because it's important. It's important to me. And it's important just to express that I am not tricked by the time. We all have the world record, which is 24 hours. That's the world record. We have a daily reprieve that's contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition, and that's it. So whatever I did yesterday, to me, it doesn't count. I've got to live this stuff as best I can each and every day. If I mess around with this, I'll lose it. I know that. So on the last show, I was talking about what it was like first coming to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 18. Didn't know anyone. I was one of the only young people in AA in my community at that time. And it was daunting. Plenty of reasons to tell myself that I didn't belong. That I was making too big of a deal out of it. I'm only 18 years old. And at the time, there were a lot of people who, you know, there were a lot of people who gave me shit for being so young. So I had that to battle as well. I don't see that as much today. I see young people very supported in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it wasn't quite like that when I got sober. Well, there was one time I remember a guy went off on me, just absolutely went off on me. Just right in my face like an umpire and a manager, screaming right in my face that he had spilled more than I ever drank and that I didn't belong there. So I had that kind of thing to deal with. From my perspective, I was jealous of people who continued drinking. I was jealous of people who got to drink until they were 30, 40, 50, 60. I was very jealous of that. That's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to get sober. Believe me, I didn't want to get sober. Believe me. If I could have kept drinking, I would have kept drinking. The last time I drank a fifth of gin and a bottle of Long Island iced tea in about 15 minutes. I got into a car. I blacked out. I came out of that blackout screaming at people that I didn't know on the street. They got into a car. They took off. I looked down into my hand. I had a bloody clump of hair in my hand. I did not know whose hair it was. Blacked out again. you know, I'll talk about that more another time, but eventually I flatlined. I died from alcohol poisoning. And I wound up at Alcoholics Anonymous. I just didn't have a choice. The way I drink is, it's just a matter of how quickly can I put enough alcohol in me to stop my heart. So, I needed to come to AA. So, to pick up kind of where I left off last time. You know, I'd been going to meetings for a little while. I didn't have a sponsor. I'd drive myself to meetings, make myself attend meetings, deal with all that fear. I mean, there was so much fear. You know, when I got sober, I didn't think that I had any fear. I thought I was fearless. I really did. But, you know, as time went on, and as I did the steps and inventories, and as my head cleared, and I began to understand what was going on, I was consumed with fear. It was all fear. And that was a lot to deal with. So, you know, I started to realize that I was going to drink again if I did not start doing something other than just attending meetings. So they kept saying, sponsor, get a sponsor, you've got to get a sponsor. So this is for me deadly serious. I need to get sober and I need to stay sober. So I start looking around the room for someone to be my sponsor. And I'm sort of sizing people up and, you know, find someone who has what you want. A sponsor is assigned to some people. That was not the case for me, and I'm glad. Knowing my personality and who I am, I don't know. It's moot. I want to say I don't know if I would have gotten sober. What I tell people today when they're saying, well, I want to look for a sponsor, what I tell people is, you imagine that everyone that you know in AA is walking around holding a cake. And that cake is representative of their life and their sobriety. And I tell people to go around and sample people's cakes. Try them. And if you find a cake that looks like chocolate but it tastes like shit, disregard what they say. If you find a cake that is delicious, then ask that person for the recipe and you'll end up with the same thing. That has been my experience. I've really had two different people really explain the big book to me. First one was my sponsor that I got, which I'm about to talk about. And, you know, at the time he had something that I wanted. His sobriety was appealing to me at that time. And then as I grew, his sobriety became less appealing to me, and I ended up really getting the message that I have today from another gentleman. And I will talk about him another time. But what I was looking for initially was someone who was serious about recovery, and to me, that was someone who was the same inside of meetings as they were outside of meetings. And that was hard to find. There were a lot of people that sounded amazing in meetings, and then I would talk to them in the parking lot, and they'd be like, oh, that fucking bitch, you know. I mean, and all of a sudden, there was no God in what they were saying. And to me, that didn't check out. I didn't want to end up like that. I wanted to be shown this by someone who was talking about God and the big book inside meetings and was talking about God and the big book outside of meetings. So I finally found a guy. And I would still call him my sponsor today. you know. But he scared me. I was completely full of shit. Everything I thought was bullshit. Everything I did was bullshit. And I needed redirection constantly. I needed redirection, you know, if I'm being honest, I needed redirection just every 10 seconds. I mean, I didn't have a thought that was congruent with, you know, recovery. And so I know myself, and I know how much of a liar that I was, and I knew how much of, you know, I knew what I was capable of pulling off on other people. And that was one of the things I looked for too, was someone that I knew saw right through me. I needed a personality that was bigger than mine, because I had a really big personality. I was a really obnoxious, angry, opinionated little fuck. So I needed someone who was bigger than that, but was also serious about the 12 steps and whose energy checked out inside and outside of AA rooms. So I found this guy. His name's Greg. And I thought, you know, I'm going to ask him to sponsor me. He looked like a biker. He wasn't a biker. He was a truck driver, a retired truck driver. He had a handyman service. And but he looked like a trucker to me. He was a short guy. He always looked angry, and he always sounded like he was angry, but when you actually talked to him and listened to what he was saying, he was very wise, and he was actually very loving to me. He was very loving, but he spoke in a way that held my attention. He would always start conversations in the exact same way, which annoyed the shit out of me. His conversations would always start with, I would say, "Hey, can I talk to you?" And he would say, "Well, do you want me to lie to you, or do you want me to tell you the truth?" That was how we would start all of our conversations, and that would set a certain tone that I needed. So I decided I was going to ask this gentleman to sponsor me, and, you know, a day went by, another day went by, another day went by, another day went by. Finally, I'm like, oh, you know, I'm going to drink if I don't do something now. I can feel it. And so he was standing outside of a meeting during a break. And I sort of paced around him for a few minutes, approaching him, chickening out, walking away, circling him, sidling up to him, walking away. He probably thought I was psychotic. Finally, I worked up the nerve and I walked over to him again, and I said, I was wondering if you would sponsor me. And I mentally, I was like covering my head. I was like ducking. I was covering my face because I just imagined some negative response to that that was going to hurt me. But right away he said, "It'd be an honor and a privilege. I can't get you sober and I can't get you drunk. I'll tell you what I did. Here, come with me." He pulled me inside the meeting, went over to the literature counter, gave me a pamphlet called Questions and Answers on Sponsorship, handed it to me, said, "Read this, call me tomorrow." I said, "Okay." Well, I didn't want to tell him that I couldn't read. I started getting Fs when I was in sixth grade. I stopped trying. I did not apply myself in school for years, so he asked me to read something. I'm just lost. But I took the pamphlet, and I said, "Okay," and I did my best to read it, and I grasped very little of it. And I called him the next day, and he said, "Let's get together," and we got together, and we went to a coffee shop. And back then, we were always going to coffee shops, and back then, everybody was chain smoking in coffee shops, so we were both sitting there in a coffee shop, chain smoking. And I'm telling him my story. And I tell him about what brought me to AA. I tell him about this moment when I was done having delirium tremens, that I was draining this bathtub and that I'd never got in, and there was this cold water going down this drain, and I don't know if I dreamt it or I don't know. The first few days are very, very muddy. In the last couple years of my drinking, are in and out of blackouts, so. But anyways, I had this epiphany of sorts where I was standing there, either literally or I was imagining this, and I was watching this water go down the drain, and as I was watching it, I thought, I cannot live with alcohol in my life, and I cannot live without it. I cannot drink, and I cannot not drink. I can't do either. So we're sitting in the coffee shop, and I'm telling him about this. And then I'm telling him about how I went to a meeting, and I'm sitting in the back of the meeting, and I'm looking around, and I'm looking at everyone, and I'm afraid to raise my hand and identify myself. I had never done that, despite the fact I've been going to meetings for a couple years. And I told him what I was thinking about when I was looking at everyone, and I was noticing people were sober, and they seemed pretty happy, and most of them had been sober for a really long time, and sitting back there, I unconsciously decided that whatever was going on here was bigger than me, and I was going to surrender myself to that, whatever that was. And so we're sitting in the diner talking about this, and all of a sudden he says to me, "You're on step 4, and I'll tell you why." And he explained to me how when I was standing there watching that water go down the drain, I was admitting to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, and that that was the first step, and that I had come to believe there was a power greater than myself. Good orderly direction, group of drunks in my case. But I was open to believing there was something bigger than me that would solve this, and that I was surrendering to whatever that was. And he showed me in the book where these things were, and he pointed to them, and he would always say to me, "Label this and claim this as your own experience." And to be honest, I didn't understand what the hell he was talking about. Really, until I started taking other people through the book, I didn't know what he was talking about. I did a lot of nodding in agreement that was empty. I really was lost. And, you know, he sensed that I was lost, and he really could see right through me, and he was there, and he was talking about this, and he was talking about that, and he was talking about God, he was talking about higher power, and all this stuff, and I didn't know what he was talking about. His arms were flailing around, and I was just overwhelmed, and he looked at me, and he changed the course of what he was saying, and he flipped to a page real quick and pointed at the page with his finger really hard, flipped the book around, pushed it towards me on the table, and said, "Read that." And it was from A Vision for You. And it said, "We know what you're thinking. You're saying to yourself, I'm jittery and alone. I couldn't do that. But you can. You forget that you have just now tapped a source of power much greater than yourself." I remember that. And I said, "How did you know?" And he said, "I could put my hand down your throat and pull your guts out and put them right here on this table, but I won't." That was what he said. So I did an inventory. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I did an inventory. And he would say, during this conversation, do it now. Don't wait. He kept saying the word now. He said, there is nothing in this book that says, do it next week or do it tomorrow. Do it now. So I did it. I did an inventory. If I could see that inventory today, I'm sure I would be very judgmental about it. I don't know what the hell I was doing, but everything that I was going to take to my grave was in that inventory. That I know. There were things on there that I was never going to tell anyone, and I just kind of scribbled them in an illegible way just in case somebody saw my notebook. I would write it in a way where it would jog my memory and I would know what it said, but you wouldn't really be able to read it because there were things that were horrific. I wasn't going to share them with anyone, ever. But I put it all on there. And then we got together and we were sitting in his truck. And and it changed my life. In fact, doing the four step changed my life. I remember something about the four step too. I remember while I was writing my part, sometimes called the fourth column. We'll talk about the steps in a really detailed way, much more. But I'm abbreviating a lot of this today, just to sort of give you an overview of what my sobriety was like early on, before we get to the other stuff. What it's like now. All the things that happened. Things that still happen. Why I was inspired to publish this book that I just published called The Sarcastic Big Book. What was the impetus for that? I'm going to talk about all that. As a matter of fact, the next show, I'm just going to talk about that. But when I was doing my fourth column, I was starting to have a spiritual awakening. I was starting to realize that I had treated the world really badly. It was not the other way around. Every inventory I've ever done and every inventory I've ever heard starts and ends the same way, when it's done thoroughly and honestly. And when somebody has really done the third step, it's the same thing 100% of the time. And it is this. At the beginning of it, no one has been good to me. At the end of it, I have not been good to anyone. Not really. It's quite beautiful. But I did my fifth step, and what I remember most about that experience was after I had done my fifth step, I saw a man, a stranger, walking out of a bank. And I looked at him, and I felt equal to him. I can't explain it. I felt connected to him. And it occurred to me when I was watching this man walk to his truck or car that it was the first time in my life I looked equally at anyone. Up until that moment, I looked down at you or I looked up at you. I was intimidated by you or I was better than you. 100%. No exceptions. But when I saw this man, I didn't feel that. And the realization that we are all essentially the same started to blossom inside me. And it was life-changing. It was the highest high I ever knew. And then, I had a lot of amends to make. Then we went through step 6, step 7. And again, talk about this much more later. But went through all that, going up to the amends. I had a lot of amends to make. And there was no cell phone. And there was no Facebook, and there was no internet, and I just had to find people, and I just had to show up. In most cases, I just had to show up. These days, we make appointments. That's very common today. You make an appointment, you schedule something with someone. And I did that whenever I could, but a lot of times I couldn't do that. But also, I must say, if I was able to attempt to make an appointment with everyone on my men's list, most of them would have chosen not to see me. And I'd be having a very different experience today. But, for example, you know, I brutalized my teachers in high school. There was not a teacher that I had or knew to whom I did not owe an amends. And by the time I was on the ninth step, I wanted to make amends. So I was on the firing line with this, and I would make phone calls. Does so-and-so still work there? No, they're over at this school now. Okay, call that school. Is so-and-so working today? Yeah. What time are their classes in? They end at this time. Okay, would it be possible for me to come by and chat with them? Yeah, they'll be in their room at this time. Okay. That was how I did it. And so I would show up. And I have to say, I had the most incredible human interactions with these people that were not happy to see me when I walked in the door. But just to put this into perspective, how dramatic this amends process can be, and was for me anyway. There was a teacher that I had that I just tortured. When I walked in to make the amends, they did not look up. They saw me, but they did not look up. And I told them who I was, and they said, "I know who you are." And so to go from that to fast forward, you know, 15 years later, the same teacher sends me an email and says, "I don't live in California anymore, but my mother does and she's dying. And would you please go visit her and bring your guitar? And will you please sing to her on her deathbed?" Basically. I mean, that's a transformation, to say the least. To go from not wanting to look at me to thinking of asking me to sing to their dying mother. My point to that story is, had I called in advance and said, "Are you willing to sit with me?" this person would have said no. No question. So I'm grateful for the process that I went through with that enormous stack of amends I had to do early on. I'm really grateful for it because it was me and God. You know, every relationship that you have is really about you and God. So that was incredible. And then it was explained to me that the steps are, while they're written in a linear way, they are not. They are a circle. It's a way of life. It's a design for living. It's something you practice each and every day. You live this way. In a nutshell, it was shown to me and explained to me that step 10 is basically live steps 3 through 9. Live it now. Live this way. And, you know, and then he said, "You can sponsor someone now." Well, I was a kid in the environment I had described earlier. You know, not only was I a kid, but I had like really long, flowy blonde hair, and I weighed about 9 pounds. I looked like a woman when I was a teenager. I basically looked like a beautiful woman. I was basically a beautiful woman when I was a teenager. But, you know, so I was in Alcoholics Anonymous with all these people who were in their 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s. And I'm going around, you know, looking for someone to sponsor. I didn't feel like I was qualified to sponsor anyone. I don't know if anybody does. I think if you really do, then something's off. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, it took me a long time to learn that sponsorship had nothing to do with me. I was going to try to be a conduit. I was going to try to be out of myself enough to be able to transmit a useful message from a higher power to someone else. And the results were none of my business. That took me years to learn. But when I was out initially to go try to find someone to sponsor, oh my gosh, I mean, I don't, you know, I told you last time that I found a journal that I started keeping when I was newly sober, and I mean, it was a mess. I don't know what the hell I was doing. But I was trying. I was doing it anyway. And that was the point. The point to that story is, even though I did not feel qualified, I did it. Even though I was scared, I did it anyway. I did it while I was scared. You know, if you wait for the fear to go away before you do something, then you're never going to do anything. You're just going to sit around and watch TV all day. So I need to stay sober, and I was having a spiritual awakening, and so I was willing to march through my fear. And I did. And I don't remember what the first batch of sponsees were like, but I stayed sober. Remember Bill Wilson, was trying to get sober, trying to get people sober for 6 months, and nobody was staying sober, and, you know, he was thinking, this doesn't work, and then I think it was his wife, Lois, who pointed out, you're sober. But anyways, I stayed sober, and then I would start doing these 10 steps. You know, continue to take inventory. While all this is going on, I'm bouncing around from job to job. You know, I mean, during those times, it was like a day felt like a year. You know, just the amount of thoughts and emotions that I would have, where the zigzagging trail up and down cliffs mentally. Feel great. 10 o'clock in the morning, 10:15, I want to kill myself. Why? I don't know. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm even more depressed. 6 o'clock at night, I've rebooted somehow. I'm ready to do this. Meanwhile, I'm horny. My sponsor told me, you're never going to get sober. You're too horny. That's what he told me. I was 18. So add that to all of this. If you've ever been an 18-year-old male, if you've ever known an 18-year-old male, I mean, I don't have to say anything else. It's fucking horny. So all that's going on at the same time. And at the same time, I'm trying to figure out what I want to do with my life. I'm starting to do music. But I have all these jobs. I'm trying to get myself on my feet somehow. So there was a lot. So I'm in a morning meeting, and then I'm going to work, and then I'm falling asleep in the morning meeting, sound asleep, snoring, going to work, coming home to a room I'd rent, trying to sponsor guys, trying to figure it all out. It was a mess. Then I'm in a smoky diner till 1 in the morning, talking to people who are like 100 years old. I can't tell you how many times I was sitting in a diner or somewhere talking to these old timers. And I would just, after a while, I would just, I mean, so many times, tune out, and watching their mouths moving. And I'm thinking to myself, but I'm so complicated. You don't understand. You grew up in a simpler time. You don't understand how complicated I am. I am complicated. If you knew how complicated my brain was, if you knew how complicated my life was, you would not be trying to make this message so simple. My grand sponsor died with almost 60 years of sobriety, and he would talk to me. And God knows what I was saying to him. I remember my arms flailing a lot back then, too. It's just so funny now to think, you know, that I was trying to explain stuff to someone. It's just funny to me. I didn't know anything. But he would stand there and he would listen to me very politely, and he would just, you know, very matter-of-factly say, well, you know, you gotta trust God, clean house, you know, work with others, you know. And he would tell me these very streamlined stories, simple to follow, not a lot of details, big broad strokes, illuminating these principles. And I just thought, you don't get it. I'm so complicated. You don't understand. I want to do music. I'm horny. I don't really know where I'm at with God. I don't know if I fit in here. So while I'm going through all of that, I'm trying to take people through the book. And that was when I really started to learn the book. And at first it was, you know, I would call my sponsor and I'd say, we're about to go over step two. Is this in the book? Where is step five in the book? Is it in here? I didn't know. I'll learn it all over again. And that was when I started to learn it. And the desire to drink was gone. It was gone, and I was just grateful for that. Despite the emotional turmoil I was in, I was not interested in picking up a drink, and that was more than enough for me at that time. That was thrilling. At that point, I was fine being walking on eggshells throughout the day, mentally and emotionally, and just being kind of a mess, taking myself too seriously. There were these guys one day who came up to me and they said, what are you doing on Friday night? And I said, I'm not doing anything. And they said, why don't we take you to a meeting and then you can come over to our house. They said, do you like JT? And I didn't know what that meant. I think today it would be Justin Timberlake. But they were talking about James Taylor. They said, do you like James Taylor? I said, yeah, I like James Taylor. You know, he's okay. And they said, well, we love James Taylor. Well, bring your guitar. You know, we'll come over and we'll listen to some JT. And at the time when they asked me this, they all happened to be wearing white button-down shirts. So it was just a coincidence looking back, but I didn't know what their deal was. I didn't know. I was skeptical. And so I said, okay, I'll come over. I went over there, brought my guitar. I said, what are we doing? They said, well, we're going to have spaghetti. I said, okay. So we all hung out, and I stood there awkwardly and still did not know how to interact with people. So in my head, so afraid of what you thought of me, so deeply into myself, that my stomach was just always in knots. But I was there, and then we all sat around this big table, and I'll never forget it. They put this huge pot of spaghetti, just regular spaghetti, regular old spaghetti with red sauce. Like if you were going to make a cartoon drawing of spaghetti, this is what it looked like. This big, beautiful bowl of spaghetti. And there was like, you know, five or six of us sitting around this table, and they start serving it, and then it's starting to occur to me, this spaghetti is like the focal point of the night. This is it. I was so used to having everything revolve around alcohol or drugs. And I just couldn't get over that. So I just kept saying it to myself over and over again. So this is the conversation I'm having with myself. So tonight's about spaghetti. So that's it. So this is what is being treated like it is special, this bowl of spaghetti. I mean, I couldn't get over that. And it was. That was what the night centered around, really. And it was beautiful to me. It touched my heart. And I learned something really big that night, which was that if you wanted to designate something as special, then you just did it. Nothing in and of itself was going to be special. It was going to be up to me. These people just decided that spaghetti was exciting, and then therefore they made it exciting, and lo and behold, it became exciting to me. So I got to assign meaning to that. I got to assign new meaning to that, if that makes sense. So it was special. And I thought about it a lot. I thought about it when I left. I thought about it on the way home. I thought about it for days. I thought about it for weeks, probably months. And I started to realize that I got to be an architect of my experience to a large degree. Maybe even entirely. That if somebody thought sitting around and having spaghetti was boring, then it was going to be boring. If somebody thought it was going to be really special and exciting, then it was going to be special and exciting, but it was going to be determined to a large degree by what I thought. What I deliberately started to think about. So it was awesome. So I had a lot of stuff like that happen. You know, I'll tell you my train story. I was went on a long train ride up to Oregon from California to make some amends to my mother. I wasn't sober for very long. My sponsor wasn't sure if I was ready for the trip. And he told me, I remember, I wasn't ready when I was sober as long as you are, but I guess you're going, and I think I already bought a ticket. So he said, let's get together. Let's go over some things. So we got together, and he kept saying, bring your spiritual guard, bring your spiritual guard. He said, if you meet someone that you think might be an AA, a polite way to ask them, a non-offensive way to ask them is ask them, are you a friend of Bill W.? And that way, if they're not an AA, they don't know what you're talking about. And he made some joke about it. And he thought it was really funny. But anyways, I went on the trip. The trip was awesome. The amends went great. Coming back, 4 hours from home. Train going along the coast at dusk. It's beautiful view. And I'm thinking about how awesome the trip was. But then I was thinking, there's really nothing about... There was really nothing, you know, he taught me a lot of things that really didn't come into play. But that's fine. And then I thought, well, I feel like playing guitar. So I started to ask around on the train for a guitar. Somebody said, there's a guy in the back of the train who has a guitar. So I went back to the back of the train, and there was this big man playing the guitar. And he was singing to some Spanish girl. So I sat down next to him, and I thought, when he's done playing, I'm going to ask him if I could borrow his guitar. So I sat down next to his guitar case, and there was a sticker on his guitar case, and it said, one day at a time. And I thought, what did Greg tell me to say? He said, are you a friend of Bill? Are you a friend of Bill, some Bill W? Are you a friend of Bill W? Are you a friend of Bill W? Okay. So I sat there rehearsing the question, are you a friend of Bill W? The guy stopped playing. I said, are you a friend of Bill W.? And his eyes welled up instantly. And he stared at me like I was an angel. And he put his hand out without moving his body and grabbed my hand. And without saying anything, he slid a notebook that was on the seat next to him that he had been writing in and handed it to me. And what it said was, I have been sober for over 2 years now. I have not been to a meeting for a while, and I'm starting to forget where I came from. And it was mind-blowing. And we sang. And the word that comes to my mind when I think of describing him was jubilant. He was jubilant. He was just this huge man just dancing around. He was so happy. It was just so... We had an AA meeting on the train. It was amazing. So I had experiences like that too. I got a lot of experiences like that. And I will talk about them. And I will talk about them. And then after all of that, finally I'm sober for 1 year. And I'm standing outside of the meeting. I've just taken a cake. And the desire to drink returned. And that's where I'll stop today. And that will lead me into the decision that I made to publish the Sarcastic Big Book. So we'll resume next time from there. But I just wanted to kind of get early recovery out of the way in my own life. So you sort of got a little bit of a sense as to who I am and what it's been like for me. I don't edit these. I'm not going to. I'm not even going to listen to them. I just turn the microphone on. I'm going to talk for a while. And I'm going to put it out there as it is. I really hope this helps someone. I'm going to help as many people as I can. And that's it. I have an incredible life today. And, there's nothing more to it, really. So, I'm really glad that you listened, and I hope you come back next time. You know, a friend of mine listened to my podcast, and he said that there are a lot of facets to my personality that he is looking forward to hearing in future episodes. I don't think any of those really came out today too much. I sound very serious. And normally I'm not, but I think these, particularly these two shows, you know, they warrant that. You know, I don't know. So anyways, I hope you have a great rest of your day. As a matter of fact, no. I'm going to go try to live a life that was worth saving. That's what I'm going to try and do. And I hope you do the same. And feel free to email me at sarcasticbigbook.com. Or no, sarcasticbigbook@gmail. And sarcasticbigbook.com is the website. So we'll have guests on future shows. Next time I'm going to talk about the book. And I'll resume this story. Good night. Thank you.